Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with acclaimed classicist James Rahm about his new book, Since You're Mortal, Life Lessons from the Lost Greek Plays. The truly happy man ought to stay at home. Hunger and lack of coin put a stop to love. Hades, alone of the gods, does not enjoy bribes. These quotes and many others from the great Greek dramatists, including Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Menander, were preserved long after they were written when a man called Stobaeus in the 5th century AD collected them as a way to instruct his son. Stobaeus' quotes represent the only traces we have of countless lost plays of ancient Athens, pithy packets of wisdom expressed in eloquent verse and selected with the father's discerning eye. Some prompt aha moments, others offer wit or dark humor, still others express penetrating moral insights. And with this volume, James Rahm becomes the first to translate these fragments as verse for English language readers. James Rahm is James H. Ottaway, Jr. Professor of Classics at Bard College and editor of the Ancient Lives Biography Series from Yale University Press. He is the author of several other studies of Greek and Roman history, and his reviews and essays appear regularly in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Review of Books. James Rahm, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So I just want to quote first a couple sentences from your book. Sometime in the 5th century AD, as the Roman Empire was collapsing in the West but holding up better in the Greek-speaking East, a father in the Balkan city of Stobi was raising the son he had named Septimius. So this father, I guess, came up with an idea. His name was John, Johannes or John. He was going to look to the texts of the ancient Greek playwrights and come up with a book of quotes for his son. I guess that's what happened?
Exactly. Yes. He was looking back about a millennium to the time of classical Greece and dredging up or excerpting the passages from Greek literature that he thought had the best guidance for a young person setting out in life.
So this was, I guess, a range of plays. Do we know how many authors were included eventually in his massive book?
Became massive. Most of the quotes in his collection are from prose. So he quoted from Plato extensively and Aristotle and other Greek philosophers. He used these quotes from drama, from both tragedy and comedy, sort of as the appetizers. So each chapter would start off with these very short, very pithy quotes from drama, almost as a way to get the reader, get his son, interested in that topic. And then he would pile on long, sometimes very laborious quotes from other authors, from prose authors. So these quotes from drama are really the lightest and the most witty of the selections in the volume.
Mm-hmm. So he became known as Stobaeus, which is literally the man from Stobi, I guess.
That's right. It's a Latin term that means the man of Stobi. I guess his first name mention was a little bit too humdrum for the scholars that study this sort of thing. So they gave him the epithet Stobaeus.
Do we know anything at all beyond his massive volume about Stobaeus?
No, everything we know about him comes from the volume itself and from the historical context. We know that he lived in the 5th century AD, which is a time when most of the Roman Empire, really all the Roman Empire, had become Christianized. But there were still many people practicing the old pagan religion. And we don't know for sure which side of that line Stobaeus fell on. His name seems to indicate he's Christian, but the quotes in the volume are exclusively from pagan authors. So it's hard to say what his beliefs were. He certainly represents the wisdom of the pagan world, the classical Greek world, before Christianity had even come on the scene.
And you mentioned that, yeah, he might have been Christian, we don't know, but the pagan view of the world and the pagan view of the afterlife here, which is a very different view of the afterlife than the Christian view.
Yes, indeed. He speaks at length about Hades, about the underworld, about Pluto, all those classical ideas of the afterlife. And of course, it's a very gloomy place that one goes to after death. It's a place that has really no joys or pleasures. One of my quotes is from a Greek tragedy, "No wedding cake is baked among the dead." That is to say, we have to leave behind all the things that give us the most joy when we go under the earth. So these are all pagan Greek ideas, Greek classical ideas, and uninformed by Christianity.
And one of the quotes at the beginning, "Hades alone of the gods does not enjoy bribes." This is not just a pagan view. Death is inevitable, inexorable.
That's right. All the other gods can be persuaded to give their favors by means of sacrifice and other kinds of offerings, but Hades alone does not enjoy bribes.
So I guess you started out, and then this became a massive volume. This is just some selected quotes in this present volume, but to understand that you and a team are working on the full work.
That's right. I was recruited to do the portions of the compilation that come from drama, and there's a couple of dozen people doing various other portions. It's such an enormous work. It requires that big a team in order to put it into English. It's the first time it's been translated into English. So it's remarkable to find a work of this magnitude from the classical world that has not yet been translated.
Tell me about that process of the art of translation.
So I'm translating lines of verse. Classical drama was entirely in verse, and I'm translating into verse, into English verse. So I thought that it was important to capture the poetic quality of these quotes. A prose translator has a very different kind of task, and most translators opt for either prose or verse, depending on where their talents lie. I've done both in my career, and I find I much prefer the task of translating verse. It's a great challenge and a great pleasure to take lines that are in iambic trimeter in Greek, that is a 6-beat line, and somehow fit it into a 5-beat line in English, because our ears are used to the 5 beats of the iambic pentameter. That's the meter in which Shakespeare wrote his plays, almost all the dialogue and speeches of his plays, and also of Milton's Paradise Lost and other kinds of classical English literature. So I chose to use that line, that format, for my translations of tragedy, even though the Greek line is longer and has to be streamlined a bit to get it to fit.
And are there difficulties? Because you want to preserve the meaning, but you also want to preserve the rhythm.
Right. And you want to preserve the length. So I tried to fit, if I have a 2-line passage, I tried to fit it into 2 English lines and so on, so as not to lengthen Stobaeus's quotes, because their brevity and their pithiness, their compactness, is really part of what makes them so effective.
Tell me about the rhythm, the power of verse versus prose. In the book, you cite Shakespeare. I love the example you use. "Neither a borrower nor a lender be," versus "don't borrow or lend." The first sings and the second falls flat.
That's right. Yes, rhythm and sometimes rhyme are very effective in helping us keep these things in our heads and making them more potent. It's just as if you set it to music, you know, the way that lyrics stick in our heads if they're accompanied by a tune. Another example one might cite is the way in which almost everyone remembers which months have 30 days versus 31. We have a little rhyme, right? 30 days has September, April, June, and November. How many times in my life have I called those lines to mind in order to remind myself where I am in the calendar? A rhyme, a rhythm, or in some cases a melody, just make a piece of wisdom or a piece of information that much more sticky in the mind.
By the way, this was Johannes, who became known as the man from Stobie, writing this for or collecting these for his son Septimius. Do we know anything at all about Septimius? What happened to him?
Unfortunately, not. We only have his name thanks to a prefatory letter that accompanied the compilation, which has since become lost, but luckily someone in the 9th century AD who was reading this massive doorstopper recorded some words from the letter. And so we know that there was a letter and it was addressed to this man, Septimius. What he made of this gift and whether it led him toward the good life, as his father was hoping, we really have no idea.
So one of the big facts about this massive volume is many of these quotes that Stobaeus included are the only things we have from some plays. Some are lost, other than a few quotes.
Exactly, yes. If you look at a collection of the fragments of Greek drama, as they're called, that is, the surviving quotes from plays that have become lost, you'll see the notations of as to where they come from, what the sources of these quotes are. They're almost all from Stobaeus. So, thanks to his volume, we have an enormous array of remains, these scraps of what used to be an enormous body of Greek drama, from which 46 plays have survived intact, but all the rest have perished, except for quotes preserved by Stobaeus and a few other authors.
Therein lies a tale. Tell us about that. Why did some authors have many of their plays survive and other plays disappeared?
So Greek tragedy, to take just the example of tragedy, and you know, we could also talk about comedy, but Greek tragedy was written by a number of people, by dozens of people, all through the 5th century BC and into the 4th century. So more than a century of historical time. And in each year, there were three playwrights chosen to produce four plays. So that's 12 plays per year times over 100. That's more than 1,200 plays written. And of those 1,200 tragedies, we have only 34. So, and those come from only three playwrights, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. It seems that the Byzantines, the monks, scholars, scribes who were transcribing the texts that they found on papyrus, on these scrolls that were the principal medium of literature in the classical world, and putting them onto vellum books, that is, books with leaves made of animal skin. Now, papyrus is a very perishable medium and also fairly inexpensive compared with vellum, which is much more durable but also much rarer and requires a lot more treatment. So one had to be very selective about what one took from papyrus and put onto vellum. And they selected, these Byzantines selected the seven plays of Aeschylus that they thought were essential reading for a student or a fan of classical drama, then the seven plays of Sophocles and seven more of Euripides. And those were the canon of Greek drama. And then by chance, another 14 plays of Euripides got preserved. We don't exactly know how. So there was a winnowing out, or a bottleneck, in which only a few plays got through based on the choices of the Byzantine scribes, and others that were not recopied simply died because the papyrus scrolls decayed or were eaten by worms, and there was no copies left from which to make a new copy. So it's a very, not a random, but a very selective process by which we have these few intact plays out of a huge corpus that was subsequently lost.
And you say in the book that these plays were written post-performance. Today a playwright writes the play, it's maybe even published simultaneous with the play being produced.
Yes, the plays that were put on in Athens in the 5th century were not thought of as a permanent possession. They were put on once in the year, one time only, and not preserved as literature until somewhat later, when the Athenians realized this is an enormously important literary genre. We have to have a record, we have to be able to go back and look at them. And at that point, they became library possessions. We don't know exactly how a copy that was put on, 10 or 20 years earlier was retrieved and then recopied. Probably it was an actor's script, as is the case with Shakespeare. Sometimes Shakespeare's plays are preserved only because an actor's script was available to the compilers of the first folio.
I want to quote you from the book. You talk about high classical Athens and these plays. They showed an entire city-state wrestling in the shared space of the theater with vital questions of ethics and politics through the vehicle of inherited myth. And you say that in a later period, the plays began to serve more as entertainment. That's, I guess, what we're... I mean, we're familiar with very serious theater as well, but much more familiar with the theater as entertainment. Tell me more about the entire city-state wrestling with vital questions through the vehicle of these plays.
Sure. So, first of all, it's important to know to be able to picture the performances that took place in Athens. As I say, once in the year, as part of a religious festival, the Festival of Dionysus, at an outdoor theater, the Theater of Dionysus, on stone benches, the audience seated on stone benches, and the performers just on a simple stage platform. In front of the stage platform is a circular space called the orchestra, in which the chorus would dance and sing odes that respond to what they're seeing on the stage. So the chorus, if you've read an ancient play, you're familiar with the fact that the chorus is an essential part of these dramas, that there's a body of fairly ordinary people, the citizens of the city, the citizens of Thebes or Athens or Corinth, wherever the play is taking place, that are watching the play and responding to it in these odes that are sung and danced, and that have the kind of editorial content that the audience themselves might be experiencing. That is, they have a kind of moral response to what's happening on the stage. If someone's being killed, or if there's an act of incest, as is uncovered in the play Oedipus, the chorus are reacting. And the fact of the chorus is hugely important to understanding the civic function of the play. That is, it's a way that the whole city is contemplating the kinds of questions the play raises together, and the chorus is allowing them to do that or encouraging them to do that. So the chorus was a feature of the 5th century and the tragedies. Later, the chorus died and was replaced by a simple musical interlude in between acts of the drama, and no longer had this editorializing or moralizing function. So that's why the play, one could say that the plays became more a form of entertainment and less a form of moral struggle. That is, the chorus was no longer present. The audience was simply interested in how this is all going to turn out, how the plot is going to be resolved.
I was reminded by reading a short story of P.G. Wodehouse, of all people, talking about Greek tragedy, that I think you can tell me if I'm wrong, that in some of these plays, if the playwright considered this to be too traumatic, the action happened offstage. Don't know if that's the case.
I'm sorry, I lost a bit of your question
Oh,
there.
yes. My understanding is that in a certain period of Greek theater, if a certain action was considered too traumatic to be seen, it happened offstage.
That's right. Greek tragedy never presents acts of violence on stage, with one or two exceptions. It's perfectly okay if one hears someone being murdered behind the scrim that separates the audience from backstage, as it were. So in the Medea, for example, a play that many of us are familiar with, Medea murders her children and one hears them crying out, but it takes place inside the house that is behind a kind of a scrim. Then the bodies can be brought out and the horror of what's happened can be made visible, but the actual murder is kept off stage.
What's going on there? What does that tell us about this period of Greek civilization, do you think? You contrast that with today. People go to horror movies, and you want to see the actual gore in excruciating detail.
Yes, it is a huge difference from our horror entertainment. Or from the Romans, who of course had their gladiatorial games where one got to watch killings on stage or in an arena. There's a certain level of decorum there that it's just not seemly, it's not appropriate to make people witness these sorts of things. And it's not good drama. Aristotle, who analyzed the way in which Greek tragedy works or doesn't work, referred to the prominence of spectacle, what he called opsis, the effect of visual, the impact of visuals on the audience, was the least important feature of Greek drama. Character and plot to him were much more important.
Let's take a break. We're talking with classicist James Rahm. He's James H. Ottaway, a junior professor of classics at Bard College. His new book is Since You're Mortal: Life Lessons from the Lost Greek Plays. And we'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking with classicist James Rahm. He's out with a new book. It's called Since You're Mortal: Life Lessons from the Lost Greek Plays. Many quotes were put into what became a massive volume by a man named Johannes. He came to be known as Stobaeus, a man from Stobae, and he collected these for his son Septimius. And these quotes in this massive book in many instances, are the only fragments we have from many lost works from the Greek period. So, James Rahm, I want to have you talk just so briefly about some of these authors, playwrights, from which we have full plays, and then talk about some of their lost plays. So Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, what are some of the well-known plays that we do have the full plays?
The well-known plays of those authors that
of those authors, yes.
That we have intact. Euripides' Medea, that I was talking about a few minutes ago, that's, of course, one of the most prominent of the surviving plays. Sophocles' Antigone is hugely popular today. It was put on in various adaptations in my home region of New York in four different productions over the last year. So that's rather remarkable. And then, of course, Sophocles' Oedipus, the story of how Oedipus discovers that he had killed his father and murdered his mother and then puts out his own eyes. That is probably the greatest and most well-known of the surviving plays, partly because Freud used it as the basis of his Oedipus complex.
And they're mostly tragedies. I guess there's some Aristophanes known as writing comedies.
Yes, Aristophanes' Lysistrata, which is the source of some notable modern adaptations, the story of how the women of Athens, when fed up with their husbands for promoting a long and costly war, went on a sex strike and denied them their favors until a peace was signed. And that has actually been a tactic that's been used in recent times by various societies that were fed up with war.
So even some of these more well-known classic period from the Greek classic age, Sophocles, Euripides, some of their plays were lost, and we have fragments in this book.
That's right. Most of their plays were lost.
Ah.
Sophocles wrote over 100 plays, from which we have only the 7 that were transcribed by the Byzantine scholars.
Tell me about, is it Menander? Am I pronouncing that correctly? He came from a later period, and I guess the Byzantines didn't consider him as important to put on the vellum.
That's right. Menander was a writer of comedy, or what we call new comedy in classical scholarship. That is a genre that more or less like our situation comedy or family drama, I guess you could call it, existed in huge numbers. Menander wrote, again, over 100 plays, and some of them were beloved and widely known in his own time. But by the time 8 or 9 centuries later that this winnowing out process was taking place, the copyists didn't favor his style of drama nearly as much as the Greek tragedians. So none of Menander's plays survived in books or codices from classical times. The only way we have 1 or 2 of his plays fairly intact is from mummy wrappings, that is papyrus that was used to wrap Egyptian mummies and was preserved in the dry climate of Egypt and can now be unwrapped and read. So thanks to that, we have just 1 or 2 of this huge corpus, and Menander is very widely quoted by Stobaeus. So we have lots of little snippets from his plays, thanks to this compilation of Stobaeus.
Mm. By the way, and that is not really apropos of this discussion, but it makes me think this papyrus very fragile, right? And vellum more hardy.
Right.
I'm wondering about, you know, today, you know, just personally, should I write in a paper journal or make it digital? Because I don't know if digital is going to survive.
Yes, it's we're at a similar inflection point where there's works from one medium being transferred into a different one. We're at a different kind. It's not a bottleneck in this case. It's in fact a I don't know what the right image is, but we're able to record much more information and much more cheaply than when we were putting things on paper. So theoretically, we're doing better at preservation. But as you say, we don't know what the fate of digital data is and what new media may rise and make all these digital files obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a worry. You say that since your mortal contains a doubly distilled, therefore doubly potent selection of insights from the lost Greek plays. What do you mean doubly distilled?
So Sobeius is the first distillation because he was taking from this huge corpus of tragedy and comedy the snippets that he thought were the most effective and the most pithy and had the most wisdom contained in them. He selected thousands of such quotes. And from that selection, I've taken the best of the best. So that's why I say doubly distilled. There are many quotes from his compilation that I didn't think were worth sharing with a modern audience. They don't really hit home with much impact. So I took the ones that I thought were really worth remembering and reading.
I was going to ask you how you chose. So I guess the impactful, what a criteria?
Impactful, certainly. The ones that arrest us, that cause us to say, or that raise a laugh or a smile, because some of these quotes are funny. And some have great poetic appeal. They turn on a metaphor or a trope that's particularly pleasing to the ear. So there are a number of criteria. The best of these quotes have all those things going for them, and some have one or two. But they're the best of the best from this huge body that I found in Sobeius.
So some of the famous ones, Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, Menander, also have quotes from Plutarch, right? Clement of Alexandria. Anonymous appears.
Yes. A lot of these quotes are not identified by the people who quote them. And as you say, I did use other sources besides Sobeius. There are a number that Plutarch quoted, and there are some that from even more obscure sources. But the quoter often didn't identify the source by the name of the playwright or the title of the play. So we simply have to call them anonymous.
I want to read the, I guess this is the reason you have this as the title, Since You're Mortal. This is a quote from Euripides. Since you're mortal, expect to endure mortal things. Or do you, mere human, think you should have a god's life? That's the kind of the title quote.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and I selected that for both the title and the epigraph because it sort of typifies the spirit of these quotes. They're on the serious side, they take life seriously, and they remind us that we're not going to get the kind of life that the Greeks associated with the gods. We're not going to have things go all our way. We're not going to be able to exercise control over our destiny in many cases, and we're not going to live forever. We're going to grow old. We're going to have physical ailments, and we're going to die. So expect to endure mortal things. That's the second half of the title line that I think sort of sums up the spirit of these quotes.
Let's take another brief break, and when we come back, I want to hear a bunch of quotes. Have you cite some of your favorites? I'll throw out some as well from this volume, Sent Your Mortal. And we're talking with classicist James Rahm. We'll have a brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with James Rahm. He's James H. Ottaway, Jr. Professor of Classics at Bard College. And he's the author of several studies of Greek and Roman history, including editor of the Ancient Lives Biography series from Yale University Press. He's out with a new book called Sent Your Mortal, Life Lessons from the Lost Greek Plays. And he's taking this from what became a massive volume, a man named Stobaeus, collecting quotes for his son Septimius. And Professor Rahm has translated these into English. In fact, he and a team are working on a full translation of the entire work of Stobaeus. Let me just throw out a couple of my favorites. Antiphanes. Our life is like wine. When there's only a little left, it turns to vinegar. Looking at our mortality. Another one, anonymous quote, living is a fine thing provided one learns how to do it. I guess that's in the spirit of Stobaeus. He's trying to pass that on to Septimius.
Yes, indeed.
What are some of your favorite quotes?
Well, I have so many. I mean, really, all of these are my favorites. That's right. How they were chosen. But if I were to select a few, I would take from the chapter on ethical life, which is entitled Virtue, Poor Creature, because the title quote of that chapter is, Virtue, Poor Creature, I See You Are Only a Word, from an anonymous playwright whose character was despairing of the ethical lapses of people around him. That chapter contains another anonymous quote, the happiness of the bad casts blame on the gods. Now, we don't believe in the gods of the Greeks any longer, but we could reframe that to say the happiness of the bad is a mark of corruption in society. That chapter also includes a two-line quote from Euripides, cry woe, this is some more than human evil when one knows what is good and doesn't do it. And that's a couplet that rings in my head every time I pick up the newspaper these days. Everyone who blushes seems to me a good person, from Menander. And one last one. No one admits to himself to being bad. That's one that really makes us stop and think about what it is that we call bad, but to the person who's doing it, it doesn't seem that way, or he's not willing to admit it. So that's just a small sampling from one chapter. There's many chapters, but that one seems to me especially pointed in our current moment.
Yeah, certainly. These are timeless. That's an illustration, from millennia ago. The human condition was the human condition.
Indeed.
Here's a few. Go ahead.
And that's really what I hope the reader will gain from this selection, is that the concerns and the hopes and dreams and the frustrations of people 2,500 years ago are really no different than ours. That sense of connection to the past and realizing that the ability to realize that the people of long ago are really very much like ourselves. I think that's the best I could hope for from this volume.
I just want to share a few more here. Consider your siblings to be your truest friends. That's a hope, right? If we have money, we'll have friends. A truism, right? Oaths sworn in lust are not enforceable.
Yes.
Humanity, an adequate cause of disaster. It's kind of a sardonic, pithy. Yeah.
Right. Yes, and there is a sardonic edge to some of these quotes, especially the ones from comedy. Menander, in particular, was very fond of tearing away the veils or the niceties of bourgeois life. You quoted something earlier from him, hunger or lack of coin puts a stop to love. That's another example of the hard-edged realism of the comic quotes in the volume.
Here's one from Diphilus. Time is a strange craftsman. It refashions all of us, but makes us always worse.
Yes.
I
From
guess
the chapter
physical decay.
on aging.
What are some of the main themes here? Part of those you fashioned yourself, but in Stobaeus in general, I guess it'd be themes that we. The main themes we face today.
Yes. Well, Stobaeus starts off his collection with chapters on virtue, on justice, on injustice. So the fact that he put those topics first, I think, is indicative of his ethical focus that he was trying to teach his son, above all, to be a good person. So there's a strong ethical tinge to a lot of these quotes, a lot of the ones that I've selected. And then there's also the sense that we're following a path of life from beginning to end. So the final two, the last deal with aging and death. And that's also following the arrangement of the original volume of Stobaeus, which ends with long discussions of those topics. So he was kind of imagining his volume as a journey across the course of a life.
Here's one by Anonymous. Don't seek again the rose you once passed by. Very, very good advice. Just a couple of minutes left in the discussion. I'd like to kind of pull back to the 30,000-foot level of classics in general. You're a classicist, folks in the, I guess, the Greeks mostly, Romans as well.
That's right.
What in general? What do those works? What could those works best tell us today? Why would you urge people to go and rediscover those works?
The Greeks had just an enormous talent for getting to the heart of things, whether it's in philosophy, where they were looking for absolute truths, or in mathematics, where they were looking for the absolute rules of geometry and trigonometry and calculus, and in human life, in literature dealing with the problems of human life. They went straight to the heart of things, asking the kinds of questions that are most essential for leading a good life. Socrates is famous for saying the unexamined life is not worth living, that one has to think about these essential and difficult questions in order to really have a good life and to be happy. And Greek literature helps us do that, helps us get to the heart of the most essential features and problems of being human.
Well, we've been talking about the book Since You're Mortal, Life Lessons from the Lost Greek Plays. Well worth picking this up. And we were talking with the author, classicist James Rahm. James Rahm, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a very interesting discussion.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.